The following program will make you want to grow things and experience new and wonderful dreams about your plants, garden, and garden design. Listener participation is strongly advised. Good evening and welcome to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101. To contact Joanne live right now, dial 905-725-1907. Toll free in North America, 1-866-905-7325. Worldwide, 1-866-656-5477. Email Joanne right now, realityradio101@yahoo.com. And now, your host of Down the Garden Path, Joanne Shaw.
Thank you, Gary, and welcome to Down the Garden Path. Thank you for joining us this evening. Once again, in the middle of July, in the heart of gardening season. As you know, my goal and vision for the show is every week is to provide down-to-earth practical advice for your garden, plants, and all things landscaping. And of course, my favorite topic of landscape design, since great landscapes start with a plan. As always, I always
Are you
say
sure?
every week, yes, they do. They start with a plan.
It starts with a plan.
That's right. So this week, we're switching gears a little bit away from the plant aspect and to the landscaping and landscape contracting part. So with all the different aspects of landscaping and landscape design that I deal with many of my customers, are do-it-yourselfers, which is great. You know, I kind of do up the plan. I make it easy for them. I might even order the plants for them and drop them off, or I might go and help them, you know, lay them all out so they're planted in the right spot. That happens a lot for me, a lot of my customers and my clients. But a lot of the time, I'm looking at bigger jobs, and those clients, either most of the work or some of the work, involves a contractor. And over the years, I've established working relationships with many different contractors, and I recommend them to my customers based on several different things, you know, timing, budget, scope of work, that type of thing. But I'm also often asked to work with my customer's contractors, so people I don't know, but I order the plants, or I go back and make sure the plants are placed in the right place, or that the work is following the design that the customer and I agreed on. So sometimes this puts me in a bit of an uncomfortable position, and so I'm looking forward tonight to talk with Scott McEachern, paralegal in the studio with me today, and we're going to talk about ways that we can protect ourselves as homeowners and as contractors in these types of situations you're dealing with. Primarily, we're going to talk about landscape contractors, but a lot of the things we'll talk about can apply to any type of contractor. So just a bit of a bio on Scott. Scott was the primary liaison and representative of the Landscape Ontario Insurance Program from 1995 through 2000. Subsequently, Scott founded the GreenSure and TreeSure Liability Insurance Program for landscapers and arborists. As such, Scott is very familiar with matters of liability arising from landscaping and arboricultural issues. He is well published with articles published in the Horticultural Review, Ontario Arborist, Lawn and Landscape, Snow Business, and other property maintenance trade magazines. Over the years, Scott served as Vice President of the Landscape Ontario Durham Chapter and sat on the Landscape Ontario Grounds Management. Wow, it's a mouthful. Commodity Group and Snow Committee. He is also the author of numerous risk management publications for the landscape profession, including Watch Your Step, as well as Proceed with Caution. Today, Scott works as a paralegal licensed by the Law Society of Upper Canada with a primary focus on litigating defective workmanship cases. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you very much, Joanne.
Wow, that's a lot. Switching gears, but definitely like my industry, so that's good. We have, even though we're coming at it from different angles, we both enjoy this industry.
It is. I fell in love with this industry back in 1995 when I started doing the insurance program for members of Landscape Ontario, and it has been at my heart ever since.
Oh, great.
Previously, I was an insurance provider to that industry, as you were just mentioning. Now, I can assist people with their legal disputes. Sometimes, of course, I work for the consumer. Sometimes I work for the contractor. And to have both of those perspectives provides the advantage of being able to see it from both points of view.
Yeah, I think that's a really big issue because customers can get really, you know, focused on their side of it and contractors the same. And I know as a designer, I kind of have to play both sides of it, but just from a concept position or, you know, design elements. But from the legal point of view, I think that would be really important in society right now. So let's start off with a basic question. What is the best way as homeowners, we can ensure a good working relationship with our contractor?
And as I answer that, I think it might be best if we answer it in two parts.
Sure.
Both with respect to what is the best thing for the homeowner to do or the property owner, as you were just suggesting. But the answer that I'm going to provide is actually also to the benefit of the contractor. Mm-hmm. I think for both sides, the property owner, the consumer, as well as the contractor, the information that I'm about to share is going to benefit both of them if they can deal with that. At the same time, the best thing that they can do is form a good contract.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest challenge that I find would arise from disputes where something has gone astray in the work, usually in that there's some sort of a disagreement as to what the project was supposed to encompass. The scope of work wasn't detailed enough. Let's say perhaps the design, which would be up mm-hmm. your alley, wasn't attached to the contract itself, and that so the various specifications, and that with the lack of specifications in the contract, well, that's where we get misunderstanding mm-hmm. of the expectations. So specifications and expectations should be coming together, and that's going to come together when we've been very clear in the scope of work that's been identified attached to the contract document itself.
Okay. So one of the biggest things is many clients ask for a quote from a contractor. They don't necessarily go out looking for a contract. And so I think that's something that consumers need to know, that they need a contract, not just a quote.
Yes, the quote document itself, I think that's really where we're going here, is we're talking about a quote as far as a written quote or an estimate. And that quite often what will happen is that'll get provided. It may be very short in summary, just some highlighted specifications as to what the job is going to entail. And unfortunately, at a later date when there's some sort of an agreement, you know, ma and pa homeowner call up and essentially say, yeah, we looked over the quote, we like it, we want to go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And when can you start? And then, you know.
Exactly. And what typically will then happen is they just put their signature on the bottom line of what was a quote sheet.
Mm-hmm.
How detailed that quote sheet is as to actually forming the basis of a contractual relationship and putting all the specifications of what that relationship is to entail. It started off as a quote. Now it's becoming the contract, and it may end up being a very vague contract mm-hmm. because the quote itself just wasn't intended to be as detailed as it perhaps should. A contract is going to be required, a proper contract, I should say, is going to be required to have a number of specifications or covenants clauses within that contract, and those specifications come from the consumer laws that are in place
okay.
here in our jurisdiction. It's the Consumer Protection Act, but for our listeners elsewhere, we're broadcasting today from Ontario. So our listeners elsewhere, you'd have to check with somebody, a legal professional in your area, for the exact consumer laws that apply in your jurisdiction. Here we have the Consumer Protection Act that we would look at for what those requirements are to be.
And probably most, like, do contractors even know about the Consumer Protection Act, you know? I mean, they're probably trying to cover there what they know that they're expelling out to their customers, but is that really what's required by the Consumer Protection Act, in your experience?
That's actually the scary part of it. About 90% of the contracts that I see that come into my office, I'm a paralegal, I do litigation in the small claims court when there's some sort of a contract dispute or defective workmanship involving contractors. Other type of work too as well, but that is a one of my areas of main focus. Mm-hmm. And I would estimate that about 90% of the contracts that come in do not meet the minimum requirements of what the Consumer Protection Act expects a contractor to put into the contract with the consumer. Now, the consumer, of course, how often do they have a landscape project done?
For sure. Yeah.
So they shouldn't be the party in this negotiation that's most qualified to put together the contract.
Yes.
The business person, being the contractor who does this on a regular basis, should be the one that's having a contract document as a template, because of course they'll have to fill in the blanks and change it based on who their customer and the project is on a specific day. But they should have a contract template that meets the requirements of the consumer law. And by failing to do that, the contractor can end up subjected to not only disputes with their customer and perhaps end up in the court process, but they can also find themselves in the as a target of the prosecution, and that the Ministry of Consumer Services here in Ontario can prosecute contractors for failure to put what they need to have in a contract document.
Is there a place to go for those templates? Is that something that, I mean, as a paralegal, you wouldn't help them provide or draft that, right?
I wouldn't be able to help them draft it. I could certainly refer them, and I get calls for this quite often.
Oh, good.
And that contractors calling up asking where they can get a proper contract document prepared.
Okay, so that's something you could help with.
Well, I can point them in the right direction. Okay. There's lawyers in town that I have relationships with that assist with that type of work.
Yeah. But I think it's important. You know, I could see people saying, well, that will cost a lot. But really, it's probably less to have that up front, like insurance, right? It's better to pay it up front than to have a problem later.
You want to need it and not, or you want to have it and not need it.
Right.
Than not have it and need it. And with a good contract document, you might be looking at, you know, $2,500, $5,000. Wow. So
that's still a lot.
It's not cheap, absolutely. However, how many jobs does it take to make that up versus how many fines could you afford to get from the
ministry? Because that's not something you'd have to do every year, right? Like, once you've done it, it's good.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that you get the template drawn up, and unless the laws change, you don't need to get this revised on a very regular basis.
Okay.
So it's well worth hiring a good lawyer that does consumer law to get your contract document drafted properly.
So in your experience, you would have found a lot of people who, if they had invested that money to start with, would have saved them a lot of trials and tribulations, literally, going forward.
They would have. And just to come back to the cost discussion that we were having a moment ago, $2,500 to get a good contract drafted up can save you having to pay me $2,500 to try to protect you when one of these lawsuits goes astray because of a contract that wasn't well drafted in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
A good, clear contract is going to save problems in the long run. And part of that, if you get a poor contract out, say you use it on 100 different jobs with 100 different clients, and then two or three disputes arise out of those clients, you have a multiple expense to then deal with.
For sure.
So do it right the first time, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, definitely. And that goes, like you were saying, that having a good contract protects the consumer, but it also protects the contractor.
Correct. And with our consumer laws, the requirements in there, as much as the contractors will perceive that the government that puts these consumer laws in place is trying to make them jump through hoops for the benefit of the consumer, quite often it is actually a mutual benefit to both, as you're suggesting. The contractor is also protected when there's a good, clear-cut contract.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know we were talking a little bit beforehand in that I think landscaping is, like you said, not, you know, how many times do you do a project? Maybe twice in your, you know, home ownership, maybe, if you did your front yard and your backyard, and maybe three if you've moved. I think there's a lot of lingo, you know, that, you know, the inside the home and other renovations, I think people are more, you know, looking for things in the contract that cover that. But I think there's a lot of terminology on the outside landscaping that homeowners don't know to look for, you know, things like restraint, base. And I know one of probably shifting and hardscaping issues when it comes to landscaping is not about the plants dying as much as it is about the walkways shifting and sinking, that type of thing. And that really isn't something you visually even see. And the customer might not, if they're not home when the work's being done, they wouldn't even know about it's what happens underneath that interlocking brick that they picked. Right.
That's exactly correct. In fact, the majority of the cases that I deal with would have to do with hardscaping, and the typical problems, as you've just pointed out, would have to do with the base that's underneath the hardscaping. What is specified within the contract, but also what is just good and workmanlike quality within a landscape project? What is required or by the trade to be under that that material,
right?
And that whether it be the interlock or a concrete pad,
yeah.
And that the base specification, as you will know, and that can be the most important thing, and what we quite often end up with some sort of a defective workmanship case.
Mm-hmm. So, would in your experience, would the contractor have said, you know, they put 6 inches of base in, or and then they didn't, or would they, or then it's just still failed, or would they have not specified how much base? Because I wonder that's kind of a varied.
Yeah, we run into that where the base material wasn't put in as thick as it was supposed to be, or an improper base material. Maybe it was contaminated with some sort of organic material.
Mm, that's really important. Homeowners don't realize that there shouldn't be soil mixed in with the base. The base should be clear, right?
Yeah. The base, absolutely. It needs to be something that's infertile.
Mm-hmm.
There shouldn't be anything organic in there that can lead to a plant material growing, because that's going to certainly push up on the materials above it. The base material as well. And then again, this is now your forte,
yeah.
And that, but the base material needs to be able to deal with proper, you know, with the drainage in the surrounding area.
Right.
Just make sure that you get the water through it, so you don't end up with frost heaving. You get those paving stones now sticking up, creating trip and fall hazards and so forth. Compaction, of course, and
yep.
That is going to be required. But the majority of the cases that I see have to do with either the base material or the actual structural material itself, and that the cap, and that with paving material or concrete, I'll often see that shorted, and we have to go in, and when we're doing a legal case, we'll extract core samples and be able
really?
To find out how thick the base actually was, as well as how thick the cap material was.
Okay. And one thing I've just learned recently, too, is that the base, if customers are doing a walkway, the base has to be, you know, a certain, I'm not going to quote what it is. I can ask my contractor guys that should know that. But the base has to be a certain requirement. But if it's a driveway, and same thing with the brick can be a certain type of brick, and the base can be a certain type if it's for a walkway. But if they're actually interlocking the driveway, then it has to be a different, not all brick can be used on the driveway. And I think that's a common thing for the do-it-yourselfers. They don't know that. Same with, they create walls, they'll stack, you know, paving stones and make a wall out of it, and it's not meant for a wall. So, you know, we can't do anything about the do-it-yourselfers that make a mistake, right? They can't sue themselves. But so that's something that I think homeowners, you know, when picking brick or when picking contractors, need to know when one is way more expensive than the other, if they're getting multiple quotes, to ask questions, because those are really important things, you know, because you see that all the time. You can drive around anybody's neighborhood, all of our listeners, I'm sure you can drive by a house in your neighborhood where you can actually see the tracks in the interlock driveway into the garage where the driveway has sunk from the, you know, the homeowner's driving. And really that means the base wasn't done properly, as well as the brick, you know, might not be the appropriate brick for that hold the weight of a car, of a vehicle.
And that'll be something that a true professional versus the fly-by-nighter is going to be able to specify properly within the project specifications, put into the scope of work, and going back to how we led into this, make sure that that makes its way into the contract so both sides know what they're expecting, what should be done, and if a legal dispute arises from that, how that's going to be treated, and that what was required, and was that requirement met.
Yeah, and it goes back to you get what you pay for, too, doesn't it?
It does. Unfortunately, if people want to avoid paying somebody like me, and that you need to pay a fair price for that, I have a saying that the price of expertise is less than the cost of ignorance.
Mm.
And that, so if we want to get good quality work done, yes, you're going to have to pay for that. You can go on the cheap, but you're probably going to pay for it eventually one way or the other.
Yeah, for sure. And we see it all the time. Absolutely. All right. Well, let's take a pause now, and we'll pause for a commercial break, and we'll get back. If you have any questions, please feel free to email or tweet or call in to us here at the studio, and we will be back on Reality Radio 101.
For that very unique and personal gift? Then look no further. At Pamper Me Organically, we have that very special gift for that very special person in your life. Pamper Me Organically is a Canadian-owned and operated company that specializes and sells organic bath and beauty products. Come in and visit us locally in the Pickering Village Courtyard in Pickering, Ontario, or visit our website at www.pampermeorganically.com. We ship worldwide for all of your online purchases. Call us at 416-629-1952. That's 416-629-1952. Remember, at Pamper Me Organically, we never sell any product that contains harmful chemicals, fragrances, colorants, or animal ingredients. We are Pamper Me Organically, where you always get great products at a great price. Welcome back to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101. To contact Joanne live by telephone, dial 905-725-1907. Toll free, 1-866-905-7325. Send Joanne an email right now, realityradio101@yahoo.com. And now, back to your host of Down the Garden Path, Joanne Shaw.
Thank you, and welcome back. You are listening to Down the Garden Path on Reality Radio 101.
That's called Intern Put Music, but no commercial to the music.
Is that what that was?
Yeah, but
we were kind of like,
but not labeled.
We were Leave It to Beaver.
Apparently, there's a commercial they're producing, and they didn't put the commercial, but they didn't. You know, there's nothing marked on the sheet here. So, well, he just got an F. That's okay when I grade him.
That's good. So you've got a new stock of interns helping you. Gary has a challenge with interns.
Well, people that want to help. They think they hand me stuff all the time, and it's not right.
Yes.
Never is.
Yes. But anyways, it was good music. I mean, it could have been worse, right?
Yeah. That's okay, because Ward and June Cleaver had a beautiful garden.
You think so? Okay. Yes. Excellent. Well, we are talking landscaping and the law here with paralegal Scott McEachern. How'd I do? Good? Better?
Very good.
Okay, thank you. So welcome back, and I hope this is a help to our listeners, whether you've had a past experience or whether you're considering doing something in the future. I think this is really good information for us to hear about. So Scott, we've talked a lot about the contract in the first little bit here, and is the contract the most important thing? Is it...
Well, the contract is, the place, as I was suggesting earlier, the place to start off.
Okay.
And that a contractor, for the protection of both the contractor and the consumer, needs to table a good, clear contract that, as was mentioned, has a clearly spelled out scope of work, attached the design to it, so both parties know what they're getting into. The consumer knows what they're buying, and the contractor knows what they're selling.
I'm just going to have one little thing. When you say design, I mean, I know what I would do provide as a design. When contractors do those little napkin sketches and stuff, is that still qualified as a design?
Well, it is. Is it a quality design?
Okay.
You want to put something down on a napkin and attach it to a contract document or a quote that later gets signed off as a and becomes a contract. Sure, you could do that.
Okay.
Right now we're back to the hypothetical question of what is a contract, and we get into this quite often, that a contract doesn't necessarily need to be black and white writing on a piece of paper that's signed off in pen. If people wanted to take a video of smoke signals, if they wanted to take Egyptian hieroglyphic picture, as long as you have somebody that can interpret it and read the hieroglyphics, that could be a contract. Of course, pen and paper, that's the way that it should be. You want to use a napkin, sitting in a donut shop, having a meeting with your client. You could do that. You're probably going to run yourself into some trouble, though, because I can't imagine that it would be clear and precise enough to avoid all problems that could arise.
For sure. Okay. And I like to hear that, because I think great landscapes start with a plan. And I think it's really important from the homeowner's perspective. And I know I'm biased as being a landscape designer, but I think if the homeowner knows exactly what they want, or they don't know and they want to work with a designer to come up with exactly what they want, then that's the point. Once we've done that together, I think that's my value add. Then going out and working with a contractor or several contractors and providing quotes, that's really kind of the best steps. And again, I'm saying that because I'm biased, but I think that's the best way to do it. Let's get back to the whole contract issue. So the contract isn't necessarily the end all and be all. I mean, I'm sure there's contract disputes.
There is, and I'm just going to wedge something in here with the segue that we're trying to get to. What starts as an original contract with certain specifications, as I'm sure you know, and the contractors and consumers out there know as well, projects quite often, they become fluid. We have an idea in the beginning of what we want to do. Then as the project starts and is underway, we start to have new brainstorms, some fresh ideas, and suddenly the project is taking a left turn from the way that originally started out. Those changes, they need to be very clearly spelled out in some sort of a change order.
Oh,
so
okay.
Whether that's going to be a new revised contract, or at the very least, some emails that go back and forth. The best thing the contractor can do after there's been some sort of change orders or some instructions is go and sit down, send an email to the customer stating, as per our conversation a few minutes ago, blah, 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 and here's going to be the additional price, or here's the adjustment
idea.
In the price.
Okay, good idea.
There needs to be a paper trail as the project changes. Again, if the contract that was just as important at the beginning of a job, if that doesn't resemble the end project, then we're going to run into the same sort of problems that we would have without a contract.
Okay.
We don't know what the finished product was supposed to be because of the changes that occurred between the product or between the original contract being prepared and all the changes that occurred between the time that the project is finished.
Yeah, because I can design something and then they start digging and there's a tree stump there or there's something else. Definitely, things change. So I think every job pretty much is pretty fluid.
So back to your question a moment ago, is the contract the be-all, end-all? Absolutely not. A contract is really just a really good starting place to know what we are supposed to be doing. what the written expectations are. But in law, we have this concept. It's basically implied terms. So you have your expressed terms within a contract. Those are the things that are either written down or were verbally said. Obviously, it's better to have them written down because people can always say, you never told me that.
Yeah, exactly.
And so if it's written down, we now have our expressed terms of what the agreement was supposed to be.
Okay.
And in law, we also have this idea of implied terms. Nobody is ever going to be able to sit down and write the expressed terms in a complete fashion. And that you're going to have a 7 billion page contract to address absolutely everything that is expected.
Right.
And that the implied terms, there's been so many cases in the courts over the years. Judges have imposed implied terms on contractors and even consumers as well. I'm going to go with the contractor example here in a moment. Various implied terms will get read into the contract whether they're there or not. So we may enter into a contract that says, hey, I want you to build a pond in my backyard. I want it to have a waterfall at one end. And if we just leave it at that, well, what is a pond and what is a waterfall?
Right.
Hopefully the specifications were more detailed than that. But even if we have more specifications attached to that, there's still this out in the air, up in the cloud, so to speak, to use a current metaphor, with some of the expectations as to the quality of the workmanship.
Okay.
Quality of workmanship, there's this concept called good and workmanlike quality. What is good and workmanlike quality? Well, in that if you take 10 contractors that have the same credentials, what should all of them be producing as a finished product?
Okay.
And if something is below that standard, then it hasn't met the good and workmanlike quality test.
Good and workmanlike.
Okay. Good and workmanlike. That's an implied term that gets read into contracts that involve the construction trades, such as landscaping, of course. And there's an example that I like to use. This goes back to the days when I was dealing with the Landscape Ontario Insurance Program, where a contractor, he was hired by a homeowner to come in and build a pond. It was going to have a very large water feature at one end, waterfall feature, I should say, with your rock and,
yep,
and
so forth. Yeah, a lot of rock wall kind of thing.
Exactly. So the homeowner wanted to save a few dollars here and there. And when the contractor came to the homeowner after doing some soil tests and said, we have a soil stability problem here, we're going to have to build this pond, do the excavation and construct the pond with a concrete liner. It's going to drive up the price. Well, the homeowner, of course, now debates with the contractor, saying, well, I don't want to spend that much. Let's just do it with the vinyl liner. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's going to be okay. Contractor keeps pushing him. No, you need to spend the extra money to install a concrete liner. The soil will not withstand the weight of the rock wall that's going to be at the one end. Well, sure enough, the homeowner, and that as much as people think that the customer is always right, the contractor falls for that one and does the job in accordance to the instructions from the consumer, the homeowner.
And then what's in the contract? So the contract said that, right?
Correct.
Okay.
So the contract ended up having the specification that he's to do it with a vinyl liner. Mm-hmm. So he goes and he does it that way. And at the end of the day, and then, as you can imagine, what happens a few months down the road, or it didn't winter and in the springtime, you have this rock wall that has now collapsed into the pond. So you end up with a very expensive cost of repair, and the homeowner's coming back after the contractor, and the contractor's just putting up his hands saying, hey, I did what you told me to do. This is not my problem. Unfortunately, in law it is, and that this good and workmanlike quality expectation, this implied term within a contract, imposes a duty on the contractor to do what it's going to take to meet the expectations of what was to be accomplished. And that if the job is to create a pond with a water feature at one end, a rock wall with the waterfall off of it, the job obviously wasn't to have a whole bunch of rocks laying in the bottom of a
really expensive pile of rocks, right? In a puddle of water.
Exactly. So that wasn't the the intent of the work. And that's in the consumer laws too as well. So it's not only this implied term, what we call common law, judges' decisions that impose this, but the consumer laws now impose it too as well, that you have to meet the expectation of the client.
So even though the client was wrong and the contractor followed what the client wanted and the whole mindset, like you're right, everybody thinks, oh, the customer's always right, the contractor was still at fault.
This goes back to the way our parents taught us, you know, just because, you know, the kid next door was doing something doesn't mean that we should do it, or somebody told us to do it doesn't mean we should do it.
Jump off a bridge.
Exactly.
Right? We all had that jump off the bridge.
That was the example.
If your kid, your friend's going to jump off the bridge, are you going to jump off the bridge? I grew up in Welland where there were bridges where you could jump off into the water. And so I think if my dad's listening, he'll say, he'll remember saying that to me. So, yeah, that's really interesting. So how do you, now is that something, a case you had to resolve? Like how does that end up being?
I've had many, many cases that involve this. And it's unfortunate that contractors, when they come to me looking for legal guidance, and of course they'll show up with a written contract and say, hey, I did it exactly as this contract called for. I've met the requirements in the contract. This is the way that the customer wanted it done. I did exactly what the customer wanted. So it can, at that point, it's my challenge to explain to them, well, unfortunately, you still missed the mark. You failed to meet the legal requirements because there's these implied terms, whether it's written down on paper or not, that you have to meet the expectation of the project. It has to, it has to comply and it has to perform in the end to what its purpose was.
Yeah. So in that situation, it's a, the best thing would be for the contractor to walk away, right? Like if they can't get through to the customer that they know best.
That's exactly true.
Know.
If the customer is pushing the contractor to do something that the contractor knows is likely to fail, the contractor needs to walk away from that type of project. The customer is not always right, and that despite the common phrase that the customer is right, that is not true, and the contractor is going to get himself into legal trouble finding that out.
So even if, let's say the contract was already signed, that the contractor was willing to do the work and then change, like how does a contractor get out of that? Is that, you know?
Yeah, if things were to come out midway through a project, so for example, if there was an original specification, they get halfway through the project.
Because let's say they do the whole backyard and the pond is like, so everything else is going great. The patio and the gardens are going great. But then when they get to the pond part, that's where the wheels come off, right?
Yeah, if something were to come off like that, that's when a contractor or the consumer, either side, needs to be checking in with some sort of a legal, getting some legal guidance on what do we do here to remedy this situation. We've now discovered something that was previously undiscovered and perhaps undiscoverable until this, until we've gotten this far along in the project. It's now throwing a wrench into things. If I continue, I'm going to open up a can of worms and potentially put myself at legal risk. And if I just abandon the job, and that I could also be in a legal risk. So once somebody gets painted into a corner, they're between a rock and a hard place. They need
literally.
Exactly. Literally. They need to be calling to get some guidance.
Okay. And a paralegal is a great way to go, right?
Here in Ontario.
Okay, yes, true, Ontario.
Yeah, paralegals are quite unique here in Ontario versus in other jurisdictions. We watch American TV. We understand that paralegals are really the paper pushers or the assistants of lawyers. Here in Ontario, paralegals can actually represent cases. We're governed, we're licensed by the Law Society, and we actually take the lead. We're not just simply the assistants. So here in Ontario, yes, they could call a paralegal as long as the matter is going to fall in the scope of the small claims court.
Okay.
If it, in Ontario, if it's going to be a legal issue that would cost more than $25,000, not in the small claims court, then it needs to go to a lawyer.
Okay. Okay. And then in the U.S., if you're listening from the U.S.,
They should just, you know, talk to a lawyer or a legal services provider in their local community. That person will be able to vet the situation, act as sort of a legal triage center, and figure out what direction the person needs to go in, and at least point them or refer to them somebody that can help.
Yeah, for sure. Because I have seen that a number of times. You know, while you were speaking, a couple situations came to mind where, you know, everything else went really well, and the contractor did a really good job to a point. And then it's a shame because when the wheels came off at that one point, in this case, your example was the pond. My case, it was, you know, something else. It's just a shame that the whole job gets abandoned and not completed because of that. So,
That's going to bring us up to a very interesting point. I think I'll turn it back to you, though, before
sure.
I get to my next point.
Okay, so we will come back and get to Scott's next point after taking a look at that, Gary, eh? So we trained him really well his first time in the studio. It's taken Gary months to train me. So anyway, we're going to pause for a commercial break. You're listening to Down the Garden Path with Joanne Shaw, and we will be right back on Reality Radio 101. You can't bag it.
Looking for a great place to go for excellent coffee and delicious treats? Come visit us at Three Steps Up Coffee House in Whitby. Our coffee is made with freshly ground free trade coffee beans that are brewed at just the right temperature for the ultimate coffee drinking experience. Try one of our mouth-watering handmade treats that allow you to enjoy a little slice of heaven. We offer hearty organic soups such as butternut squash with toasted almonds and sweet potato carrot and ginger. There is something for everyone, from healthy salads to gourmet sandwiches and delectable chocolate treats. Contact us to find out more about our amazing catering services. Find us at 605 Brock Street North in Whitby, Ontario. Licensed under the Liquor Control Board of Ontario. Open Mondays to Saturdays, 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. Seating for private functions and events available. Contact us by phone at 905-430-7817 or check out our website at www.threestepsup.weebly.com. Three Steps Up Coffee House. Three steps up to a perfect cup. Looking for that very unique and personal gift? Then look no further. At Pamper Me Organically, we have that very special gift for that very special person in your life. Pamper Me Organically is a Canadian-owned and operated company that specializes and sells organic bath and beauty products. Come in and visit us locally in the Pickering Village Courtyard in Pickering, Ontario, or visit our website at www.pampermeorganically.com. We ship worldwide for all of your online purchases. Call us at 416-629-1952. That's 416-629-1952. Remember, at Pamper Me Organically, we never sell any product that contains harmful chemicals, fragrances, colorants, or animal ingredients. We are Pamper Me Organically, where you always get great products at a great price. You can reach, but you can't grab it. Welcome back to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101. Send Joanne an email right now, realityradio101@yahoo.com. Hey, now back to your host, Joanne Shaw.
Thank you, and welcome back to Down the Garden Path, where we're talking, like I say, down-to-earth practical advice. I think this is down-to-earth practical legal advice.
It is. Thank you.
From my guest, paralegal Scott, and who's joining me in the studio tonight. So we were just talking about contracts and workmanship, and often, in our pond situation where things started to go unravel. I've come in after the fact sometimes, and the contractor's done a really good job, and then just at some point, you know, midway through the project, wheels start to come off or things start to go wrong. what is the best, you know, what's next before things come completely, you know, off the rails?
Well, the most important thing either the contractor or consumer can do is to avoid any knee-jerk reactions. Mm. As the wheels start to come apart, relations may get a little tense between the consumer and the contractor. However, if either one of them, and that just suddenly up and abandon the project or abandon the relationship, that can create more of a legal problem for themselves than the original problem was
going to
create.
So that's not the answer.
Anyway. No, it is not. And as we were, just before we went to commercial, I was explaining this concept about good and workmanlike quality, and that's an implied term within a contract. It doesn't need to be written into the into the contract. It's there whether it's written or not.
Okay.
Now, with that, essentially it creates an implied warranty that the contractor is going to do the work to that level or that particular standard. There's also a statutory warranty, quite often comes in the consumer laws, where the standard is going to be prescribed by some sort of actual act of here in Ontario, our legislature, mm-hmm. and it's going to impose those standards. So with a warranty situation, there'll be the express warranty. Most contractors will have something explicitly written into the contract.
Yep.
And then there's these implied warranties or statutory warranties that get put into an agreement, whether it's written there or not. And if there's a knee-jerk reaction, and let's start off looking at it from the consumer point of view. If the consumer just gets fed up with the contractor and says, you know what, you did this wrong, and this wrong, these are all defects, and I'm kicking you off the job, I'm going to hire somebody else, I'm going to get that person to correct your defects, and then I'm going to try to stick you with the bill for it.
Mm.
This can now be a breach of the duty to mitigate.
Okay.
And there's this concept in law called duty to mitigate, where you have to give an opportunity, or at least try to minimize the costs before you can go after another person for causing you those costs.
Okay.
And when there's an implied warranty or the express warranty within the contract, you have to give the contractor an opportunity to fulfill that warranty. If the contractor, let's say in the pond example, although that was a bit of an extreme mm-hmm. situation, but let's simplify this. I'm just going to use paving stones, for example.
Okay.
So let's say the contractor offers a one-year express warranty written into the contract, or even the industry standards would be, whether it was written there or not, that there's an implied warranty of 6 months, or that it's going to make it through the first winter without some frost heaving. Come the next spring, there's some frost heaving. If the homeowner were just to take a knee-jerk reaction, call another contractor in to that defect, and then try to sue the original contractor for the cost of hiring the second contractor, now the consumer can have a bit of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't mitigate. If they had called the first guy and said, hey, I have these problems, can you come back here and fix it? It should be covered under your warranty. Then the first guy can come back, and of course he's going to absorb that cost himself. He's not going to have to, or at least most of that loss himself. He can just eat the labor cost. Hopefully there's no additional material costs,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't cost him anything to do that. And therefore, any cost that it does cost him is absorbed internally.
Right. Mm.
So the other side of it is when a contractor, and that has the knee-jerk reaction.
Okay.
The contractor gets
fed up. Let's
say
the customer is being unreasonable and demands, and the contractor gets fed up and walks away.
And in that situation, if the contractor walks away, or what we call abandons the project, he's putting himself into, and I shouldn't use he, but the contractor is putting themselves into the position where they may then have to pay for the cost, the increased cost of having another contractor come in and finish off the work or correct the work.
Mm-hmm.
We see this quite often with the hardscaping projects where there's some sort of a defect as we're heading into the fall, or we're getting close to the winter period where frost heaving or mm-hmm. other winter conditions could potentially cause a problem. Now you have a homeowner that needs to expedite some repairs before those problems arise.
Yeah.
And what they're going to do is they're going to go hire a second contractor, and you're going to pay a premium rate
Yeah.
Because of the expeditious nature that they're needing to get this done, and then that premium rate, they're going to go back after the original contractor, and he's going to have to pay that loss.
Or I can sometimes see, because in that situation, you know, they say give the job to someone who's busy. So if there's if he finds a contractor who isn't busy, they might not be as qualified as the first guy to do the repair too, right?
That too.
You know, you're calling, you know, Joe Schmo to fix something that, you know, the first contractor had the expertise to do it, but now you don't, because you're rushing. You know, homeowners do have that panic of that time frame, and they want to, and we see it often on social media, you know, I want somebody to fix this tomorrow or fix this by the weekend. And, you know, the guys that are around to do that are necessarily the most qualified.
And sadly, that's scary. You know, the rock and a hard place expression. Quite often I'll see that with sloping situations. Mm-hmm. So you have some improper sloping. You now have some water that's being misdirected toward a structure. There's the risk that there could be some ingress of water into the structure. You end up with some foundation cracking or other water problems. If this arises at the end of a hardscaping job, let's say we're into September, October, now you have a homeowner that needs to get this dealt with quite promptly. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. Who's available to do that work?
Yeah.
The professionals, those that are highly qualified, they've probably booked many months in advance.
Mm-hmm.
You start calling around, and the homeowner at that point may end up just taking whoever's available. And then the original contractor, they're going to yell and scream that somebody else came in to fill their shoes that maybe added to some new defects.
Was
it the original contractor or the new contractor that did things in a hurry that created the additional defects while they were trying to fix the first defect?
Yeah, definitely. I could see that happening too. So I think a lot of it comes down to you get what you pay for. And like in within our homes, I think everybody's familiar with the lingo. We know that you need a good subfloor for your hardwood and things like that. But I think it's really imperative for customers, clients, to really learn a bit, especially if you're looking at a major project. If you're looking at spending a lot of money, then you really need to educate yourself on the terms of the contract and ask questions when you see a contract, and make sure that you understand everything that's involved. And you know, searching out good contractors. I have talked about that on the show with a contractor himself and with a couple of them actually about things to look for as a good contractor.
Yeah, when the consumer's vetting contractors, the most important thing is to avoid fly-by-nighters. Now that can be easier said than done.
Yeah.
Avoiding fly-by-nighters. How do we know who the fly-by-nighter is? They may have a good quality workmanship or a portfolio that shows that they've done good work, maybe have some referrals and so forth. There's a few things, though, that I like to point out, and quite often I'll get a hard time in response from the smaller contractors out there, because it sounds like I'm discriminating against some of the smaller contractors, mm-hmm. or suggesting that they should be avoided. And I'm not directly suggesting that.
Right.
However, if a homeowner wants to protect themselves, they need to think in the same sort of way that a large business would think.
Right.
If we, for example, here in Southern Ontario, we think about the City of Toronto, the way that the City of Toronto project managers would go about having a contract bid for,
mm-hmm.
and that they're going to put it out to tender to companies such as, Ellis Don, a massive contractor that puts up skyscrapers and builds bridges. And that when they do that, they're going to be asking for things like bonds and so forth. Now,
right.
Ellis Don is going to be able to jump through that hoop with no problem whatsoever. Yeah. But consumers need to do this as well. So as much as we talked earlier about project specifications and make sure that what you want is written into the contract agreement mm-hmm. itself, that there needs to be some specifications as well as to what we're going to use in our selection criteria when we hire a contractor.
Right.
One of the most important things is make sure that you're dealing with somebody that has some financial pockets. It doesn't have to be an extremely deep pocket like Ellis Don. It doesn't need to be a massive international corporation. But you want to deal with, you know, something that's more than a small contractor that couldn't afford to correct his mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Something I find quite interesting, and of course this goes back to my insurance career, You'll see this in the Yellow Pages, contractors advertising fully insured. You'll see this homeowners looking for a contractor. They'll be asking all the time, are you insured? Do you have liability insurance?
Yes.
The interesting thing, when a contract goes astray and there's some sort of defective workmanship, a failure to do what should be done, insurance doesn't cover that.
No.
Insurance will cover the consequences of defective workmanship.
Right, the flood, if there's a flood, but not...
Correct. So if if there was a hardscaping job was done, let's say there was some sloping, instead of draining away from the house, it now drains towards the house and floods the basement. And that, well, the flood in the house, that'll be covered by the contractor's insurance. The homeowner, of course, may directly sue the contractor or put in a claim through the homeowner's insurance, and then the homeowner's insurance coverage will go after the contractor for the damage inside the house, the consequence of the poor workmanship. The cost of correcting the poor workmanship itself, such as tearing out the hardscaping and reinstalling it properly with a slope going away from the house, that's not something that's covered by the contractor's insurance.
Oh, okay.
So the contractor should have deep enough pockets to be able to absorb that loss, that he's going to be able to come back under the warranty, because, of course, that would be a failure to do the work in good and workmanlike quality.
Right.
So he now has to come back and correct that mistake. And if the contractor can't afford to pay to correct his work and out of his own pocket, and that's the kind of contractor that a homeowner wants to avoid.
Yeah.
There's ways to investigate that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's, you know, a contractor in the local area that has 100 trucks in its fleet.
Yeah, then that's not, yeah.
It's probably, you know, going to be able to afford to write a $10,000 check if it makes a mistake.
Yeah, I know, because often, you know, it costs more. You know, sometimes I'll have customers that just want a tree planted, but they think, you know, the guy in the blue truck with the shovel can just plant the tree for $100. But there's a lot that goes into planting a tree properly. And I say to them, you know, yeah, you can go spend $100, but when that tree dies, you're not going to be able to find the guy in the blue truck, you know, to replace that tree. So you need to spend the $400 it really costs to plant the tree properly, you know. And that's another example of it. And I think from a contractor's point of view, something you mentioned to me, and I know I do as a designer, I know what I don't know. You know, if I'm called to a site and there's a lot of grades and it's a large property and there's a lot of, or recently backing on to conservation. I mean, there's laws and that's required. I mean, those, I don't know that. And I'm not going to say that we can put a retaining wall on conservation property to retain your backyard. I know I need to refer them elsewhere, that they need a landscape architect. And I had this recently with a lovely customer who's, I just love her. And I did her, I ended up doing the front yard, but when I looked at her backyard, there was no way. I knew I was out of my depth, and I knew she needed to deal with a landscape architect who had the background in conservation. And I knew no matter how much she was willing to pay me, I was not the designer for her for that backyard, as much as I, you know, I saw the potential back there. So I know myself, insured and errors and omissions and all of that, I know what I don't know, and I know when to walk away. And I think contractors need to know that too, right?
That's a wonderful way of looking at it and conducting yourself and doing business. Know when you're crossing the line beyond your own expertise. And from the consumer point of view, doing business with a contractor that says, I don't know, but I will find out, that's the kind of person that you want to trust.
Excellent.
The know-it-all that says, oh yeah, piece of cake, I can do that, I can do that, I can do that. That's the one to run for, run from.
Run from, yeah. Those should be definitely red flags. So, wow, we covered a lot. Boy, that Aragon Radio goes really quick, doesn't it, Scott?
It does.
So I wanted to thank you very much for joining us tonight. And I hope you'll come back again. And I hope our listeners got a lot of information out of this tonight. And if they have questions, Scott, is there anything, as we ramp up, is there anything else you want to mention or promote?
Well, yeah, if the listeners have questions, they need some help with the legal issue, they want some further explanation from what I was speaking about, you could call me. My phone number is 905-259-5460, or you can find us at paralegalsoshawa.ca.
Excellent.
Paralegals with an S, Oshawa, O-S-H-A-W-A.ca.
Excellent. Well, thank you again. And I'd like to thank our listeners for joining me down the garden path tonight and for another great show. So we'll talk to you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101.